Is it okay like that? Fine. Good. That was good enough, yeah. All right, thank you. So everybody hears me well, that's fine. So good afternoon, happy to be here. I think you'll see very quickly that I'm not a cybersecurity expert, I would say, or not at least a technical expert. So I come from a different background. So I don't know if some of you have heard about resilience engineering. Anybody? A little bit, maybe. So it's resilience engineering, and I'll describe that briefly. But it's essentially a look on safety that comes from human factors and then those kinds of fields, and also system science and those kinds of things. But so it's a different way of looking at cybersecurity than trying to provide and provide food for thought for you who are thinking about crisis management and thinking about cyber events and those kinds of things. So when resilience is kind of a buzzword these days. It has been for some years. Lots of people have talked about resilience in different systems. A lot of research came from ecological systems initially, material science also. So for example, when you hear the word resilience, people associate with the capacity to absorb some kind of shock or disruption, the capacity to bounce back or bend and take its shape back and those kinds of things. But we are in a different position in the sense that we're looking at human systems and work systems in particular. So human systems have other characteristics than ecological systems or material. For example, we think, we analyze, we anticipate things, we reflect on how we behave, we can adapt, not over generations, but we can adapt immediately. So all kinds of things that really change what it means to be resilient and how you are resilient. So at a high level, the kind of definition of resilience for us is basically this idea of being able to maintain some essential functions in the face of disruptions, whether they are expected or unexpected, which is an important aspect of things. And resilience engineering is basically this belief that we can build in resilience in different ways. We can build it in work systems through technology, maybe through training, the way we train people, we form people, educate them, or it's with how we organize the processes, how we organize the structure, for example, of decision making in an organization. Those kinds of things. So lots of different types of intervention that could potentially build resilience purposefully in the systems. So Mary mentioned my PhD is in cognitive systems engineering. It's sort of a subfield of human factors and ergonomics with a strong systems-oriented view, which sort of changes the way you think about some themes. For example, it changes the way you think about safety compared to a more traditional safety type of research or risk type of research. For example, we're very interested in understanding things like safety in real-world systems and not in the lab. And that has consequences. That has consequences on the kind of methods that we use, on the kind of things that we are interested in, what we track when we go, for example, do observations in fields. We don't set up lab experiments, for example, as much as traditional psychology or human factors would do. And the fact that we're looking at real-world systems also means that we are very conscious about the fact that there are strong characteristics of real-world systems. For example, there are things that you can't escape. We have finite resources. Time is not something you can avoid. Those kinds of seems very obvious, but sometimes I think that unfortunately those dimensions are sort of overlooked. And also, it means also for us that we are we face some very fundamental trade-offs in the real world. For example, this sort of acute versus chronic problem, the specialist generalist type of problem. I mean, these are real world systems problems that you can't avoid. You can't pretend that it's not there. And one of the consequences of those problems is, for example, that no system in the world can be fully known, can be entirely described. So any model is going to be necessarily a limitation and a simplification. A very useful simplification, but a limitation nonetheless. So it changes sort of the perspective of how we think about, for example, risk, what it means to do risk analysis. If you have that perspective that you can't know everything, that means that you have to be prepared for also unexpected expected things. Okay, So what I'll describe in this presentation is a study I led a few years ago on cybersecurity. We had the opportunity basically to go and observe a 12-hour training, which was a red versus blue type of exercise set up in the US by the Idaho National Lab. And they do a lot of trainings for different people, but this particular one was for the energy sector. So they brought in they had 40 people from the energy sector that was split into a blue and a red team. And basically, as you can imagine, the blue team was trying to defend the system, the red team was trying to attack it from the outside. And that's the kind of basic, what you see here is the basic situation, right? You have some organization that's you know, producing something. There's a physical process of some kind. In this case, it's electricity. And in order to do that, they rely on some technology, for example, controllers and systems such as SCADA systems that sense and control the physical process. They rely on data servers. They rely on workstations to communicate with the data servers, etc. So all kinds of network items that are associated with process control, but also all kinds of items that exist because it's an organization. So it has administrative needs. It has needs to share information with partners and with buyers, etc. So it has all kinds of network type of assets that are more or less connected to the outside. And so the classic situation is here what we were interested in particularly is attack from the outside. And so somebody or a group of people would try to take advantage of the connectivity of that organization to get access ultimately to the process and disrupt the process. That was the goal of the red team. And because that possibility exists, there are some cyber experts that are in charge of defending that network. Ultimately defending the process, but in order to defend the process, defending the different layers of networks and subnetworks. So that's the basic situation. What we were interested in, if you look at the literature on cybersecurity, it's mainly technical. It's mainly focused on the defense itself, and mainly focused on the when you're talking about defense in that kind of situation, on network intrusion detection and those kinds of themes that are extremely important themes, but at the same time very, very focused. And so what we were interested in is also looking at the other aspects of cybersecurity. For example, what does it mean to do defense, to provide cybersecurity in the context of an organization that has other goals? Cybersecurity is not the primary goal of the organization. So that relationship we were interested in trying to understand better. What does it mean also that the fact that it's an adversarial type of situation is interesting in itself. So that theme was important for us to look at as well. Also, in order to understand what attacks mean, and we were trying to figure out whether we could model the behavior of hackers through this study. And ultimately also there was a sort of methodological aspect to it. So as I was saying, 40 participants, a scenario that was designed by the trainers, the domain experts. And so a red and a blue team, 10 people in the red, 30 people in the blue team. All right, so here, first, essential characteristics, some of the findings. I'll hit you up front with it, but I'll come back to those throughout the lecture. Essentially, cybersecurity, when we're talking about those kinds of networks, large organizations, it's not one person dealing with everything. It's a bunch, it's a different roles, different teams. For example, there are people that are more specialized in network environments, network settings, network management. Some people that are more interested in the systems. Some people that are more interested in the databases. And all of those different teams have to coordinate in order to ultimately provide cybersecurity. Same thing on the attack side, it's not an individual. When we're talking about those kinds of hacking projects, if you will, it's rarely an individual in his basement or in her basement. It's a team of people with different competences, with different capabilities that have to collaborate in order to make progress. And technology parts takes a part in that as well, on both sides. it is fundamentally adversarial, as I was mentioning. But at the same time, I mean, it's not we're not talking about playing tennis or war or something like that. The fact that there's extremely little visibility on each other's side is an interesting characteristic of that environment. So it's very adversarial, but you only see very little bits of the activity, the results of the activity on the other side. Therefore, it's based also on lots of inferences and guesses at times. And so there's a lot of uncertainty throughout this domain about the environment, of course, because it's potentially large networks that are not fully known, about the other side's actions, as I was just mentioning, but also about own action. Sometimes on the hacker side, it's difficult to understand exactly what they did, and vice versa. And also, I'll come back to this idea that there are some interesting parallels between security and safety that you know, help us understand what it means to provide security in an organization. All right, so the collection, we had basically all kinds of ways of collecting data from different rooms that were corresponded to the different teams. We recorded also with handheld devices and ended up with a gigantic amount of data that were painfully transcribed and analyzed. What I did with that was basically to try to track what people were paying attention to. My hope was to basically try to build sort of what was going on one side, what was going on the other side, and try to see if I could do a parallel and see how people understand what's happening on the other side from that. So I initially went with this kind of matrix, but it didn't work very well. And so ultimately, I create those graphs that I'll show now. This is a representation of the red side's activity, and so I don't know if you can see the very details don't matter that much, but the idea is that you have time horizontally and vertically. It's sort of a sense of how close you are to the target, to the process in this case. Right. So the further down, the closer they were to the target. And so from the representation of their different activities, you get a sort of a sense of progress over time towards their goal. And so what I was tracking on this representation is the type of actions that are carried by the attacking team. Like, for example, successfully getting access to a machine, attempting access but failing to do access, conducting some kind of intelligence, changing some parameters in order to come back and secure their presence, losing connections, those kinds of things. And so what's interesting then when you look at the representation is that you see patterns sort of appearing. For example, this example, so you see patterns of team members trying to get access, failing a couple times, then finally getting access, changing some parameter. From that parameter being able to access something else or gathering some intelligence, branching to another machine. And so you have these kinds of recursive type of patterns, if you will, and ultimately losing the connection if they hadn't been able to secure their place, their access. So at a high level, when we think about cyber attack, there are three main processes of conducting intelligence, getting access, and changing something on the machines they have access to, the assets they have access to. Those three are interdependent functions, and all of those generate some kind of activity on the network, right? Now, this exists in the context where there's somebody on the other side that's trying to figure out what the activity is. So what's interesting is that as Red is operating, they also are generating data on the network that could potentially uncover them. So by acting, in other words, they also risk uncovering themselves. And so acting, they end up acting in a very careful way. But one way of thinking of attack is essentially about establishing some path towards a goal. So here, when I show this kind of picture, it looks very clean. You go from mission A to mission B to mission C, etc., and you get closer and closer. And you do that by, for example, understanding that there are some vulnerabilities that you can take advantage of at different parts. But the reality is actually, it's closer to this. The reality is that it's very much a discovery process for the attackers. And so they are fumbling about in the dark rather than actually having a clear path most of the time. And as they're discovering, as they're getting somewhere, they also expand a bit what they know about the network, and they discover some potential opportunities. But their path might not be very straightforward. And so as a result of that, one of the challenges that we identified on the red side, on the attacker side, is that there are sometimes conflicts between the goals. For example, they find some kind of access to a machine, but they actually don't know exactly what they can do with it, or they don't know what kind of effect it might have. They don't know what you know, further actions they could take on it. And so tactically, it's difficult to basically make tactical progress and at the same time think strategically for conducting an attack, because especially of time pressure. On the blue side, so that's the same, using the same kind of representation but tracking a little bit different things, basically what they were able to read, what kind of activity they were able to see on the network. And there are essentially two different types of activities, if I can say so. One is the type of activity they can detect. So for example, the source of activity, the access to a device, an attempt of access, those kind of things. And some of the actions that are tracked here are also the kind of activities they were conducting. So for example, investigating some kind of activity on the network, resolving, having a discussion between themselves to resolve some kind of interpretation, and that's what I was trying to track. So what's interesting to me at a high level is you don't get a clear sense. I mean, they're sort of all over the place throughout the day, basically. So it's not as if we have that clearer path as that red was showing. And when you look at some of the patterns that of activity on the blue side, you see those that occur several times, where you see some kind of activity that looks suspicious. For example, there is an inside source here where with two attempts, failed attempts to access, and finally managed to access to another asset, but from the inside. So that, from a defender standpoint, is very scary. That means that the attackers are established in the network and they're trying to get full advantage. But here what happens is basically they see that, they get a bit unease, and they finally, through discussions and stuff, after a little bit of time, they realize it's actually a team member that was trying to get access to a server and didn't remember the right password or something like that. So you have sort of like different you have goals conflicts if they don't coordinate correctly with those different teams and actors, basically they end up working at cross purposes because of all the activities they generate to conduct their work. Right, so if I at a high level, also three big functions: detecting, conducting intelligence, because they have to conduct intelligence on their own network, and responding to potential threats that they identify. And so what's interesting is also that as they are doing their normal activities, they are generating also activity on the network. And that activity looks exactly, looks pretty much the same as the hacker type of activity. It's just that, it's their own. So if they don't know that it's their own, well, they risk thinking that it's suspicious. And so that's the one of the type of challenges that they're confronted with is sort of when you think about all the sources of activities on the network, is sorting out actually what sources are the reliable, their own, the organizations, the outside, the legitimate outside, but also potentially the illegitimate outside. And what's interesting, I mean, that sounds crazy, but at the same time, one of the experts from the Idaho National Lab was very clear to say that in those kinds of large networks, because the networks are dynamic, because assets are added all the time, etc., and modified all the time, you can never know the network entirely. So that's the normal situation in those networks, is that you don't know the network entirely. Therefore, you're constantly surprised by, you know, machines or activities that you didn't know about that were added recently or that were modified. And so that's the normal work for them. And so what they face is basically the need to in the context of high uncertainty, right? So it's very noisy background with lots of data on the network, and sort of low signal data coming from the attackers. In that level of uncertainty, they have to answer those very, you know, easily stated, much more difficult to conduct or to answer these questions. I observe some kind of activity. Is it legitimate or illegitimate? As I was saying, it's a weak signal, noisy background, so it's a difficult question in the first place. Also, technology exists, of course. There are lots of automated systems to help with that question, but you know they have strong limitations and generate lots of false positives, false negatives, etc. So in the end, it remains a very human type of activity. It's not an automatic activity. So I was mentioning the fact that in large networks, especially like that, it happens. Cyber defense happens as a collaboration between interdependent roles, because they have different domains of expertise that are needed for those large networks, and so that results in potentially goal conflicts and potentially difficulties to coordinate correctly within the team. And so then there's the second question, which is, well, if we think this is illegitimate, how can we handle that, right? And that also is very easily stated, but it's a very complicated question, because as I was mentioning, security doesn't exist in a vacuum. So the organization exists because it produces some kind of good or some process that is valuable to others, that it can sell, that it can exchange with the outside data or services, etc. So those are its primary goals and primary missions, not security. Security is the valuable added benefit or feature of the network, like safety can be in aviation, for example. And so managing that trade-off is difficult, because you, in the end, you don't just unplug a machine that looks suspicious, or you don't disconnect a sub-network that looks under attack. You can't do that. You have to justify it. You have to have sufficient certainty. Usually you have to document it. You have to bring it upstairs to the actual network owners. You're not the network owner as a network defender. And so those decisions exist outside of your scope, boundaries of responsibilities. And so it's a difficult task. And so briefly, when I look at trying to put those two representations together, what I find interesting is when we look at those kinds of series of patterns. I mean, in the end, what it means is that the activity on the red side is detected on the ends up being detected on the blue side, but with more or less delay, right? So there's a time component that is quite essential about what can happen, within that delay, within that gap, more or less important between the moment activity is conducted and the moment it is detected. But typically, it is detected. Even if in the end, actually, the blue team in that particular case lost the game. So the difficulty for the blue team, rather than actually detecting that there is activity that is maybe suspicious or probably suspicious, the difficulty is actually to create, actually to make sense of this activity, rather than actually just simply seeing it in the traces of the network. And so making sense of the activity might mean understanding what the other side is trying to do, understanding where they're going to go next, if they have access to a machine or a subnetwork or something like that, what it provides them, understanding the link it might have to the process that you're trying to defend, those kinds of things. So not just detection is complicated, but it's understanding what it means in a sense. So based on those kinds of thoughts and insights. You know, there are a couple clear takeaways. I mean, one of them is, you know, this model of candy security, you know, with the hard crust, soft inside, that was popular at the time. The good thing is that it's not that much popular anymore, but that is a wrong model of security, because I mean that is essentially is the same as the Maginot thinking, you know, after the in the World War, or is the same as Donald Trump and the Mexican Wall. You know, it just doesn't work. You know, things will go over, around, you know, through the wall, and so that's not a good way to think about security, right? Now, the nested network architecture, which is a much more common way of doing things, is definitely a more secure way of thinking of things, because you're layering the different levels of criticality of the network. But in the end, you're faced with the same kind of problems. It's not because you have a nested network architecture that you actually have solved that fundamental Maginot thinking problem. Right, people will also get in there, but it's going to be more complicated. Right, so from a defense standpoint, it's very important to understand that, you know, ultimately hackers will get access. It's not a question of, you know, can they get access, it's they will get access, because the network is fundamentally about access. So as long as this is the purpose, you know, it's like when you want to fly a plane. I mean, of course, by flying a plane, you create safety issues, but that's the purpose of flying. I mean, that's not to create safety issues, but to the purpose of flying is to fly. And so by flying, you unfortunately escape the gravity, for example. So the network is access, and it's what's interesting also, it's the shared, when you think about attack and defense, the network is also the shared environment. I mean, it's the same place where both sides play. Right, and they have the same environment. They use similar tools, which is interesting. They use similar kind of competencies. I mean, there's not that much that differentiates attack from defense sometimes. And so, distinguishing as a result legitimate from illegitimate is not super easy. And in addition to that, it's not just a one shot and one shot. I mean, each side works as an adaptive system. Right, so you have co-adaptive processes. Each time adapts to what the other is trying to do, or what they perceive the other is trying to do. So I was mentioning this time component, but one way of thinking about it is, there are windows of opportunities in essence. So for attackers, between the moment that they start having access to conducting some kind of activity to the moment they are detected and they see the results of detection, for example, actions that are taken against the access they have to a particular asset, they have a little bit of time where they can do things. Right, so they want to take advantage of that. But it's interesting to think about that from the defense side as well, because attackers, you know, they don't necessarily know precisely where they're going and how to go about it. I mean, sometimes they have more intelligence, sometimes they have less intelligence, so it varies a lot, of course. But as a general rule, they are discovering the network as they go, as I was mentioning. And so once they gain access, it's not as if they can do immediately something. They need also time to understand what they can do, understand what it provides, understand if it's worth it, those kinds of things. And so as they try to understand that, they have to do it by, for example, probing some things. And trying to understand what they can do is also putting them at risk of being uncovered. So it's not, the situation is not hopeless on the defense side in the end. But it's, in the end, it's basically, it looks like some kind of chasing game between the two teams. What's interesting from a time standpoint is, definitely the attack is setting the pace. And so from a defense standpoint, it means they have to be able to keep up with the pace, making detections, of course, but also understanding in the pace of events, understanding what is going on, what the attack is doing. That's the most complicated part. So, main takeaways about cyber defense. First of all, there's in my mind an important one is this sort of perspective or attitude or frame of mind, whatever you want to call it. What some people in the literature of high reliability organization, if you've heard of that term before, called mindfulness, and there's this concept as part of mindfulness. There are different characteristics, and one of them is this concept of preoccupation with failure. I mean, a good network defender is somebody that is constantly preoccupied with failure. And it's not a good position to be in because it is stressful. But in a sense, you know, you have to design a secure network, of course. But you can't assume that it is secure. You have to make everything you can to understand your network, but you can't assume that you understand it fully. Right, so that's that kind of mind frame. And it's the same thing for plan. I mean, I know that you have talked about crisis plans and contingency plans, etc. Those are extremely important things, because they will guide your action when actually something happens. But plans, you can't assume that the plans will work. So you have to assume that actually things will, the world will throw curveballs at you, as they say in the US. So you have to assume that there will be surprises. Bigger or smaller, depending on the case. What's important to me, also coming from a tradition that is less technically oriented than most literature and research on cybersecurity, is that cybersecurity and cyber defense, in particular, in this case, is really fundamentally a human task. Of course, it requires technical skills and expertise and knowledge. You can't do much without those, so there are things that you need to build on. But it's also largely about the capacity to make sense of what is going on, based on those technical understanding, but capacity to understand a larger picture, and the capacity to coordinate with others. And so that is potentially complicated. Coordinate with team members, that can be done most of the time easily, but also coordinate with others in the network. For example, coordinate with the network owners and being able to communicate evidence. For example, is a difficult task. Evidence in this world is rarely very clear. It's not as if an earthquake hits and you have clear signs in the world that things have gone wrong and you need to address them. So evidence is a complicated notion most of the time in cybersecurity, and so you have to be able to communicate that to network owners, before taking actions, and so the network owners will not necessarily react favorably to weak type of argumentation. So if you are in those kinds of situations, be prepared to argument to make. Claims based on what you observe, and then communicate that in an efficient way with somebody who's not an expert typically in this field. And as I was saying, cyber defense fundamentally does not exist in a vacuum. It exists because the networks that provide services need to be defended and need to be secure, but it exists in this context of larger missions, larger goals. So, small question for you. How do you think, in your mind, that those points relate to things that you've seen in this course around crisis management? I mean, do you see similarities? Do you see differences? Do you see nothing? I think I could have the same slide on pretty much any kind of crisis. Maybe there are some things that are stressed in cybersecurity a little bit more, like the uncertainty. But essentially, those are very at a high level, very very common to any kind of crisis. Okay, as a quick illustration. like when we think about how we can actually support that work of cybersecurity because of cyber defense, especially because of these different challenges, in my mind, one interesting thing to think about is this: what's the network? And in the network, when we think about it, I mean, it can be typically shown on a map where we draw links between machines and subnetworks and stuff like that. But that's one way of talking about the network. You know, the network is also, you know, how much open it is. It's also about the services, the applications that it carries. It's also about, all kinds of things. You know, what it provides, how it's created, how it's, you know, the topology, how it's organized, etc. What's also interesting is that all the services are highly interdependent with each other most of the time through the network. And ultimately also, especially in those large networks, when you have large number of assets that are brought regularly, modified, etc., it's a dynamic environment. So it's sort of it's a constantly moving target, if you will, moving environment. So one question is, when you think about the network with all those characteristics that go beyond simply the links between the machines and the assets and the networks and the subnetworks, you know, can you use different kinds of representations to actually capture that complexity, to, you know, support the thinking about what's happening on the network and through its various assets, etc.? So the typical representation that I have here, blurred, but you know, you've seen probably many times. That's assets and you know, subnetworks and firewalls and, you know, the links between them. Sometimes some information about what services work on them, but that's a typical thing. What's interesting when I observed this exercise was that network representation ended up being a very central artifact. So they had printed that as a big poster in one of the rooms, and that little poster became actually the point of meeting of you know, large amount of interactions between the blue team members and between the blue team sub teams, and they came here often in order to you know, think and discuss what was going on, exchange hypotheses, exchange strategies, and those kind of things. So it became a very central artifact. So I have this video, for example.
So corporate say they will remove unless they have listened. By that time, it's too late. That's what I'm saying. You don't need a firewall. Because you decide to use tile hand behind a bed.
So you probably couldn't hear the details, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, what you see is also the amount of gesture around it, the sort of it's getting at this point. It was getting a little bit passionate on the blue side because they were starting to feel like they were losing. So you know, people were getting a little bit not angry, but yeah, a little passionate. And so, but you see the different gestures. I mean, showing assets, showing, you know, the sort of exploring where it could go from there. Try to indicate, you know, what should be done in order to prevent those things from happening. And those two guys actually were two guys from two different teams. One was a more like a systems oriented person. One was a more like a network oriented person. And so they were basically confronting their interpretations about potential risks and stuff like that, using that that representation.
Our theory is that traffic's going to come over the EX. Okay. And we need to know as it crosses PCS firewall.
Okay, so because when you guys start seeing
the same idea, he's also getting a little bit more agitated with the words and the gestures. What was interesting also to see is how the network you know, here there was a poster, right? And they were taking all kinds of notes on the poster. Because what the trainer had been very good at doing was to say, this representation is accurate. And the representation was accurate. But why then do they have all kinds of other notes? Because accurate doesn't mean complete. So everything that was on the network representation was actually correct, but it was not complete. So the people from the defense side, they kept on discovering new things, new assets that they were not aware of in the beginning, and that's part of what it is to do network analysis, network defense, is you discover the new assets, and so you update your knowledge of the network throughout. And of course a paper form is probably not the best way to do it, because you know when you have to update it, you can do it so many times, but at some point it gets complicated. But so you can imagine, when you think about designing technology to support decision making in the network defense, well, maybe there's something that could be built around this notion of network representation. And maybe a computerized version is a more fruitful, or more useful asset, for example, for the purpose of doing updates. But there are other ways, for example, having different representations of the different perspectives on the network can be a useful way to do things as well. What was interesting also to realize was how the network at some point, people that were playing the asset owners, they were role players, you know, came down and there were exchanges with what to do, and they were like not at all agreeing with closing some services and things like that. And the network representation also became a way of showing them the situation and negotiating what could be done, what should be done from a security standpoint and that kind of stuff. And what it illustrates also is the potential gap that there is between what the network is when you're the network owner and you think about the values that the network provide, and when you're the network defender and think about the more security aspect. And so that gap will exist always. And so network representations might help with reducing the gap and basically coordinate between these two types of perspective. Right, so in the end, the network map, it ended up being a very central artifact for all kinds of decision making types of activities, whether it was sense making, anomaly detection, exploring some hypotheses about what was going on, trying to anticipate the next move, etc. Tasking also each other, so they were pay attention to this, look at this firewall, the rules, etc. Decide on course of actions, etc., and also negotiate with between different perspectives. From a design standpoint, I think once again that is an interesting. There's something that can be built around this network representation that goes beyond the sort of paper representation that was so central to the exercise, but limited in nature. And that's it. Thank you. I'm sorry. No, I haven't tried that, but. No, I haven't tried that, but I think, once again, I'm not coming from a very technical perspective, but that would be something I think to explore is what can be used from a technical standpoint to help with creating network representations and creating, for example, collaborative tools around network representations. Yeah, absolutely. But then you have the issue also of exactly how you update that knowledge, who's responsible for that. It's a complicated story when you make it try to make it real and then used. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, they could detect the activity, yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I didn't mention that, but they see even less because they don't have the tools to monitor the network, so they see even less what the blue team is trying to do, and so they are constantly acting with in the mind the fact that the blue team is trying to undermine their actions, and sometimes they were interpreting, for example, lack of loss of connection, as they thought it was the result of a blue action, and sometimes it was absolutely not. It just happened that they lost connection, but they are constantly on this side. They were constantly interpreting all their successes and failures in light of a potential detection and potential actions from the other side, and often in a wrong way. In this case, the blue team was more in the defense side. Towards the end of the exercise, they started to try to move towards a more active type of defense. The active, maybe that's the wrong term, but they were trying to be more like trying to deceive them, like trying to put, for example, screen copies on the screen in order to simulate the state of a computer, those kinds of things. But they didn't do it so much in this particular exercise. But I think it's when you start thinking about the fact that it is fundamentally adversarial and it is about coadaptive processes and things like that, at some point you realize that the blue side can't be solely in a passive mode and has to have the kinds of actions that you're mentioning and be more active in, for example, making the others, making red side believe that they are. In some fashion, that they are being seen, even if it's not the case. Interesting point. They were initially. Their plan was so. Remember that this is a bit of a contrived situation because it's a 12-hour exercise. They knew, for example, that they had to, or they had the belief that they had to understand the network more. So part of the plan was to immediately go and try to, investigate the networks and try to identify, assets they were not aware of. So they had that kind of plan. But then it became more reactive, very quickly, especially as they started seeing some success, from the red team. So to answer your question, I don't remember a specific plan in this case in terms of how to react or how to handle, access to a particular asset or to a particular subnetwork, so they were not that advanced, I would say. Yeah, but I think it's absolutely an important thing to do, keeping in mind that of course the reality of the world will be a bit different, and so the plan will have to be updated or adapted to some degree. But that's the resource you need in order to start acting. Yeah. Okay, you had a question, maybe. That's a very tough question because it turns out that it's lots of people are trying to do that. We have projects right now at Syntef where we're trying to go towards that, and it's a bit complicated because we are we're talking about human systems, so you have to basically you try to understand how capable the teams, for example, or the systems as a whole adapt. That's adaptive capacity is sort of an essential component of that resilience thing. And so you try to track that in some fashion and try to measure that in some fashion. And for the moment, it's still that's a really like a research theme, but it's a very important research theme. But yeah, we're working we're working on those kind of things. But that's ultimately what you want to do because, for example, you would like to use that if you had the possibility to have indicators of resilience. You know, it would be a great way to, for example, compare two types of technologies, right? You're trying to conduct a mission X and with technology A versus technology B, and you try to see, you know, if one is more supportive of the people's actions than the other, and especially in terms of resilience. And that's what we've been doing in the air traffic management domain, for example, with the remote tower concept. You might have heard about that. This idea that some small aerodromes could be remotely controlled, and that's something that is being introduced successfully in Sweden and Norway and other places now. And so we're looking at how to measure is a big term for the moment, assess, you know, investigate whether it's actually providing resilience or what it's adding in terms of resilience, what it's potentially taking out in terms of resilience compared to actual operations.
Thank you very much.